can't ignore me.
No one can ignore me.
I'm Todd the announcer, and Eric lets me do his announcing. I'm always right there by his side to loudly announce everything he does.
Even things like coughing and sneezing.
His wife hates it.
And now, Eric Metaxas.
Wow. Hey there, Albin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay.
Today is Tuesday.
It is.
And there's a lot going on today. Folks, listen, because I'm going to talk fast. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk fast. First of all, in a few minutes, we're going to officially kick off the Christmas season by playing my dramatic reading of the Christmas book that I wrote with Tim Raglan. It is called Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. So today officially kicks off Christmas on the Eric Metaxas Show. We are going to, also in our second hour, I'm talking to Melanie Penn, dear friend. She is a singer-songwriter. She has a new album out. It's all Christmas songs. It's called Emmanuel. We'll talk to her in the second hour. But the first hour, we are going to play Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you this early. What's today, the 5th?
Yes.
I'm telling you early, so you can order a copy. I get, like, no money from this, okay? These books, I'm not going to go into it. But the illustrations are mind-blowing. Tim Raglan is a genius. The book is gigantic and gorgeous. It's like a coffee table book, and he charges, like, $20 for it. But you go to timraglan.com. You can find it. But it's called Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. Tim and I wrote this 20-something years ago. I will never forget it. It is a magical story of a bachelor bulldog. It's like all these animals wearing cool clothes as the 1920s and stuff. And he hates Christmas. So he's a little bit like Scrooge. He hates Christmas. And then he finds out that his niece and nephew, these cute little bulldog puppies, are going to visit for Christmas. And he hates the idea. He wants his peace and quiet. He has a manservant named Peeves, like Jeeves, get it?
Yeah.
And he lives in a mansion, and he's got this lady friend, Margaret Dumont. Well, of course, he hasn't married her. And he just wants to have his perfect life. And these little kids invade. So it's called Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. They kind of like blow up his world. And it is just, he's this kind of big, heavy, like almost like a Ralph Cramden figure, a little W.C. Fields, whatever. Yeah, okay, so we're going to do a dramatic reading of that any minute. I'm doing the dramatic reading, but it's 20-something years since I wrote it, and I love it. And so I say, anybody listening to me, if you have my other books but you don't have this, trust me. So many people. I was just down in Lakeland, Florida, and Betsy Phillips, Martha Linder's daughter, there are people in that world who they read this every year. Their kids have loved it since they were little and stuff, because it's years now. We were, signing these books in 1995.
Yeah.
So people have, we sent a couple to the Bush twins, okay, who are now grown girls,
sure.
Right? We sent, when they were still little girls, we sent copies to them.
You didn't send any to the Sadar twins, Albin and Anthony.
No, we didn't, because you guys were grown by then.
Thank you.
But anyway, the point is that I get all excited because it's a super Christmas story. It celebrates Christmas. It's called Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas, and we're going to do dramatic reading in the next little bit. After that, we're going to go to the steps of the Supreme Court, my friend, my Breakpoint colleague. If you don't know Breakpoint, go to breakpoint.org. My colleague who does commentaries with me every single day for Breakpoint, he's going to be there because there's a big Jack Phillips case. This is the guy with Masterpiece Cake Shop. And this is a huge, I'm not going to discuss it now, but in a few minutes we have that. Before we do that, I want to say an update on the CSI, which is, of course, Christian Solidarity International. We have raised, at this point, almost $14,000. That's still, we're not really near our goal of $50,000, but I want to say to those of you who have given, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. We are just grateful to you. This is one of these causes that it's a truly great cause to help people who are suffering in the Middle East, to know that there are people on the ground, Christian Solidarity, they've got the connections to help people who are suffering because of persecution of Christians in that neck of the woods. And there's some horrible stories. So if you want to help, you go to our website, metaxastalk.com. We're asking you today, folks, please do it. It's Christmas. Give something. Doesn't matter what you give. Give what you can give. If you are able, to give, you know, $156, we will send you an Eric Metaxas Show hat. Albin is wearing one. Albin,
yes.
Are you aware that you're wearing a hat right now?
I'm styling with
it. It's a beautiful hat.
It's beautiful.
I need to take one because it's raining in New York today. I need to take one home with me so I don't get rained on. We're going to pick out our Christmas tree today.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I'm going to take the subway up to 96th Street and meet Suzanne. We're going to pick out a tree.
Yeah, and they do sell
trees. Do I sound excited?
On the streets of New York, they do sell trees.
Well, that's the only way to get
them. They're expensive, but they're
And they gouge
nice.
You.
Yeah,
boy,
do
they
boy.
Gouge you. But that's, you know. Okay, so, but it is raining, so I'm going to be out there in the rain later. So I better get
better
an Eric Metaxas Show hat. Folks, if you want to stay out of the rain, you can get an Eric Metaxas Show hat as well. Go to MetaxasTalk.com. And go to the CSI banner, you can get a hat that way. You can't buy a hat.
No. And if you give $250, you get a hat as well. So $156 for the package that really helps the folks there.
Yeah, that's
overseas.
The magic amount. That's CSI's asking $156 if you can do that. And
$250, you get a hat as well, but $500, you get two hats. Now, what do you get for $1,000?
For $1,000, you get everything. You get like a signed Luther book, whatever. You get all this stuff. And if you ever get to New York, you get to come into the studio and hang out with us. You get like a photo opportunity. If you want to smoke a cigarette, we'll let you. Whatever you want to do.
Right.
And we have somebody in the studio right now. Albin, do you know who that guy is?
Yeah. His name is Adam. He's here from Texas.
Adam, are we allowed to give out last names?
I don't know.
Adam, are we allowed to give out your last name?
Adam English.
Adam English.
There you go.
Is sitting here with us. Adam, just you and your family pitched in to give $1,000 to CSI. You happen to be in New York City, and I want to personally thank you. People don't realize like how happy I am, first of all, that people would want to come in and meet me and hang out here, and also that people would give to CSI, because this is a clear way to help people who are suffering. It's like people say, what can I do? Give to an organization that is doing it.
Right.
Right?
And they're on the ground.
So Adam English and your family, thank you so much. Thanks for coming in here, hanging out. Okay, we're going to stop embarrassing Adam English. Okay, so now, look, folks, I got to tell you something. Before we go to the dramatic reading of Uncle Muggsy, I have been reading the work of one of my favorite authors on planet Earth. His name is Thomas Howard.
Hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, many of you don't know who Thomas Howard is. We had him on this program when we just started the show 2.5 years ago. He lives up in Massachusetts. He wrote a book, came out maybe 1969, called Chance or the Dance. It is one of my favorite books in the world. I am currently writing a foreword to a new edition of it. I want to tell you, folks, buy one now. Buy it, read it, read it with a pen, because it's so great. I was so moved by how great this book was, because, I was rereading it. I was so blown away. I said, is there anything by Tom Howard that I have not read yet? And I realized there was. T.S. Eliot, many people know the great, great, great poet T.S. Eliot, most famous for The Wasteland and the love song of Alfred J. Prufrock. Basically, T.S. Eliot became a Christian, like a serious Christian. And at the end of his life, he wrote a poem called Four Quartets. And it's the summum bonum of his oeuvre. I just use three languages in one sentence.
Like that.
That's kind of scary. Mm. It is outrageous. Anyway, Tom Howard taught four quartets to the English classes that he taught, and he wrote a book about it called Dove Descending. I'm reading it now on the subway. It is mind-blowing.
Mm.
It is everything Tom Howard writes is so great. Do I sound like I'm raving?
Yes.
I am raving. I believe it. Tom Howard, if you can buy just one book, get Chance or the Dance, and it gets better and better. There's a chapter in there on sex, like the meaning of what is this thing that God has created. Oh, if you can find a better chapter on that subject, I defy anybody anywhere to find me a better chapter on that. But it's the whole book is not about that. Okay, when we come back, you're going to hear me reading dramatically Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. I guess that means it's Christmas. Folks, check it out. We'll be right back. Thank you.
those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling you. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Giddy-up, 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 let's go, let's look at the show. We're riding in a wonderland of snow. Giddy-up, 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 it's grand, just holding your hand. We're gliding along with a song of a wintry fair.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas, I've talked about it and talked about it, now you're going to hear it. I think I did read Yankee Doodle Muggsy around July 4th, but this is the one that started it all. This is the Scrooge character. This is the guy, the bachelor, bulldog, plutocrat, W.C. Fields, grumpy character who has the little kids come into his life and turn him upside down. It's written in verse, so you got to listen carefully. If you've got the book, you got to turn the pages. Save this so you can, you know, play it at another time when you have kids around with the book. I'm so excited. Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas by Eric Metaxas and Tim Raglan. Oh, Muggsy was a happy bachelor, never married in his life, always did just what he wanted, had no children, had no wife. And neither did he have to work, nor had he very many cares. I catered to his every need. That's me, you see, upon the stairs. And now I'll ask you to relax, as this our happy story weaves. If you're in need of anything, please call for me. My name is Peeves. Oh, wifeless, childless Uncle Muggsy, singleness and freedom yours. Children never mar your quiet. No wife is wakened by your snores. And you never have to go outdoors. Oh, how you love your life, dear Muggsy. How you've clung to bachelorhood. Ever doing as you wanted, never doing as you should. And wouldn't change it if you could. And how he loves to dress his best for a romantic tete-a-tete with the woman whom I call Miss Dogmont and whom he knows as Margaret. But lo, the day before Christmas Eve, a missive came by courier. It spoke of children soon arriving. His sister's twins, one him, one her. From out his lips there crept a grrr. Gadzooks! Said he, a further shock. Their train is due at 1 o'clock, which left no time to finish breakfast or to inquire about his stocks. And as he dressed himself that day, it left no time to match his socks. And there they waited, he and she, identically uninvited. Their Merry Christmas, Uncle Dear, went entirely unrequited. Hear this, he said, my tiny guests. There'll be no celebration. Christmas is just another day for my rest and relaxation. But then their ancient traveling bag, held by a single piece of tape, unleashed a sudden flood of marbles from which no Noah could escape. And down we went, both he and I, tearing our respective pants, as did the town council and the mayor and the ambassador of France. And then in the morning he came to learn that the terrible price of the marble spill had been expressed to the last penny in 3 lawsuits and 1 doctor's bill.
Thus, Peeves, he said, does fate repay us. My singular order is become twinned chaos. But always knowing just what to do, he took the children to the zoo. And there, from his great wealth of learning, he brought out bits of animal lore, excluding neither fish nor fowl, nor the luncheon habits of the three-tusked boar. But while he told them of the tiger's stripes, the children, unnoticed, went chasing about, spreading good tidings of Christmas cheer by letting the animals out. The dinner that night began quite well. How Muggsy loved my roasted duck, as did Miss Dogmont and little Emily and her brother, whose name was Habakkuk. But the harmony was not to last. It was Muggsy himself who was to blame, for it was he that night who said it. My goodness, Habakkuk, what a funny name. And when the children were sent to bed, Muggsy could at last relax, with the lovely Miss Dogmont at his side and a warming fire at their backs. Margaret, my dear, he started to say, I treasure these moments with you. Then a bump and a crash from the west wing was heard, and he knew that their romance was through. And so to the library quickly they ran, and oh, what a scene that they found! The Julius Caesar was wearing a hat, and the Hermes was knocked to the ground. And the children were perched on a mountain of books atop Muggsy's favorite old chair, and he saw they were using his cherry wood pipes to blow bubbles of soap through the air. And when he saw they were holding an album filled with photographs from his youth, Muggsy cringed, for he knew what was coming. Your name is Ambrose, they shouted. Forsooth. Be gone, you twin rapscallions, go, cried Muggsy. Now you seal your doom. You'll stay put tomorrow. Christmas be hanged. Both locked up all day in your room. With the children departed, Miss Dogmont now spoke. Don't you know that tonight's Christmas Eve? You're a selfish old cur with a heart made of stone. And she sniffed twice and then took her leave. Oh, wifeless, childless Uncle Muggsy, singleness and freedom yours. No children there to mar your quiet. No wife to waken with your snores. Oh, how you've loved your life, dear Muggsy. How you've clung to bachelorhood. Ever doing as you've wanted. Never doing as you should. Would you change it if you could? And as he sat there, still and quiet, his blank gaze drifted to a page of pictures from his childhood. Of moments from a golden age. And there, under a Christmas tree, he saw a very happy child, which made two tears form in his eyes. But through the tears, old Muggsy smiled. When the twins awoke that Christmas morn, a silent coldness filled their room. Their Christmas hopes had all been dashed, their dreams of joy replaced by gloom. But hark! From downstairs came the sound of a laugh that boomed so the rafters shook. And helpless to contain themselves, the children went to have a look. And so to the top of the stairs they ran, and oh, what a scene that they found! Miss Dogmont and Muggsy were both wearing hats, and presents were piled all around. The town council had formed a Christmas quintet, and the mayor was singing a song.
Here we come a-caroling among the leaves so green.
And whenever they came to the chorus, the ambassador of France sang along.
Love and joy come to you, and to you glad Christmas too.
Come down, dear children, Muggsy cried. Come down, my honored guests. It's Christmas Day, so join us in our gaiety and jests. We do accept, they now replied, your gracious invitation. But what's to become, O Uncle Dear, of your rest and relaxation?
Hear this well, he said. My guests, there'll be no relaxation. Christmas is not just any day. It's a day for celebration.
And oh, what a grand celebration it was. The happiest day of his life. For Miss Dogmont that day would become an aunt just after she became Muggsy's wife. So, our happy stories told, we now shall take our leaves. If you're in need of anything, remember me. My name is Peeves.
Folks, this is the Eric Metaxas Show. I hope you enjoyed listening to the dramatic reading of Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. I hope you get a copy of Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. There's also a July 4th version called Yankee Doodle Muggsy. In any case, we'll play that again before Christmas. But right now on the phone from Washington, D.C., my friend John Stone Street. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much, Eric. Hey, I got to tell you, my daughters read Uncle Muggsy's Christmas to a group of little kids they were babysitting just Saturday.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
I love it.
That book.
Most of my good friends have a copy of Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas, so I hear about it all the time, but I know most people don't even know I wrote it, so every Christmas I try to talk about it. Thank you for reminding me. Now, you are in D.C. because today were the oral arguments at the Supreme Court in this famous Jack Phillips same-sex marriage cake-bake story. It's insane. Tell us what we need to know.
Well, I mean, this is a huge day. I mean, where this case goes is going to have huge implications for both freedom of speech and freedom of religion, particularly when it comes to what we can say and whether we're going to have forced, kind of compelled speech and our creative talents when it comes to the LGBT issue. So Jack Phillips, of course, baker in Denver, Colorado, back in 2012, ironically, before the state or the nation had same-sex marriage, a same-sex couple who had been married in another state asked Jack Phillips to custom design a wedding cake for their ceremony, and he refused. He offered to sell them anything in the store, so all the rumors that we've heard that he did not serve gay people, not true, but he just said, I cannot use my artistic talents to custom design this
cake. Didn't say you can't come in my store and buy a cake. He didn't say that. He said, I will not custom design a cake for your same-sex wedding because I'm a Christian. I don't believe there is such a thing as two men being able to marry each other. I don't want to offend you, but I can't bake your cake. That's what he did, and he's lost all kinds of money. And, of course, finally this case today is in the Supreme Court today.
Well, yeah, Eric, one of the great ironies is that he was specifically by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was found guilty of not making a same-sex wedding cake. This was 2012. Same-sex weddings didn't exist in Colorado. So, you know, he was, you know, found guilty and fined, sent to sensitivity training, lost 40% of his business for not making a cake for something that doesn't actually exist. But all that to say, the Supreme Court thankfully picked up this case. The oral arguments were today. I was there on the steps participating in a rally. I spoke with several of our friends, state policy leaders from across the nation, religious leaders, Kelvin Cochran, the Atlanta fire chief.
Oh, Kelvin Cochran, I've had him on this program. He's a hero. He's a hero. He's another one. I mean, this stuff is so important. I almost can't speak because I feel so strongly about this. This is so basic, so absolutely basic, and it's not being communicated properly in the mainstream media. They talk like he's anti-gay or something. I mean, it's really absolutely a dark time that people of faith have to go to the Supreme Court to argue that they have the right to practice their faith. It's really remarkable. This is a huge, huge case.
No, it's a huge, huge case. Now, the good news is from all accounts, the oral arguments went really well. I spoke just a few minutes ago to someone, a lawyer friend who was in the courtroom. There's reports already coming out. Justice Kennedy, of course, is most likely going to be the swing vote. And he had some really harsh words to say for the way the state of Colorado treated Jack Phillips.
Kennedy did.
He told them. Kennedy did. He said, you did not respect or you were not tolerant of Jack Phillips' religious views. Now, that could mean all kinds of things. There was an awful lot of talk about, okay, well, how we decide here, you know, what's the analogy when it comes to forcing a baker to bake a white supremacist cake or someone to celebrate an event like a Nazi, you know, important day in Nazi history? You know, how would that, how would this sort of force bakers in the future or creative professionals in the future to participate? There was also a lot of talk, Eric, about is baking a cake really the same thing as art? Now, I think, you know, you and I would both agree that when you or I bake a cake, it's not art. When Jack Phillips bakes a cake, he's using, he's one of those master cakes guys, right? I mean, he was doing it before there were TV shows.
But why does it, you see, I feel like, why does it have to be art? I mean, in his case, it is art. But if somebody says to me, bake a cake and on the cake, write, you know, Caesar is Lord. On the cake, write, kill all the Jews. On the cake, write, 2 + 2 = 5. Do I have to do that? It doesn't need to be art. I mean, it's interesting that this, you know, is being pursued this way, but why does it have to be art? Why can the government force me to say something, whether in a simple way or in an artistic way, that violates my fundamental beliefs?
Well, I think you're right. I don't think it has to be art. I think it's compelled messaging. And I think the case there is that creative expression has already has a long precedent of being protected in the First Amendment by the Supreme Court. In this case, Jack Phillips wasn't asked to write, you know, hooray, same-sex marriage. He was asked to clearly create a cake with rainbow design, which, of course, is a very clear message in our society. So basically, the point here is that it doesn't have to be words. It's participation. A random refusal.
I mean, they're trying to compare this to, like, you didn't bake a hand. You didn't serve a hamburger to a black man, and it is completely different. We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to John Stone Street about religious liberty and the Supreme Court today. We'll be right back. Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas show. I'm just hoping to be cracking up my guest, John Stone Street, by playing that music. John, did I even get a smile out of you?
Oh, man. Did flashbacks from high school.
I was going to say. Okay, well, look, we're talking about some important stuff. I want to let people know a little bit who you are. You are John Stone Street, the author of many books. You have a new book out. What is the title of the new book?
Yeah, the new book is called A Practical Guide to Culture. It's essentially a kind of a coaching manual to help people who are invested in the next generation walk their students, their kids, through the cultural challenges of our day, including the issue of LGBT issues, which is what we're talking about today, religious freedom, and so on. So that's included, as well as porn and texting and social media and addiction and everything else that parents face when it comes to their kids these days.
Okay, and what's the title of that again? Practical Guide?
A Practical Guide to Culture. Yep,
okay.
Guide to Culture.
And in case people also don't know who John Stone Street is when it comes to Breakpoint, I will reiterate that every single weekday, you, John Stone Street, and I, one of us, does a commentary following in the footsteps of our hero, Chuck Colson. And if you're interested in these are a tremendous resource. We have a team of people doing the research and just brilliant commentaries that we get to air every day. It's either you reading it or me reading it. Go to breakpoint.org. Very, very important stuff. And John, I forget the one thing that I should say. You are the head of the Colson Center. Tell us what the Colson Center is, because there are people who listen to my program, they might not know.
Yeah, I mean, the Colson Center just kind of is about helping everyday people understand and make sense of the culture. Named after, of course, Chuck Colson. Chuck not only cared about what was happening in the prisons and justice reform and prisoner rights and so on, he also cared about what was happening in the culture that was creating the brokenness that was revealed in the prison. So he started talking about things like worldview and cultural events and life and marriage and religious liberty. And so all of that part of his legacy is something we want to continue, because it's never been more important for especially Christians, but really all people, to make sense of this quickly changing culture. In fact, this case, the Jack Phillip case, is a great example. Just today, your commentary brought clarity on what Christians can do to pray for Jack Phillips, to pray for Christian Wagoner, his attorney, to pray for Anthony Kennedy, who probably is going to be the swing vote on this, to pray for clarity, to clarify what the issues are. Tomorrow on Breakpoint, we're going to look at what the oral arguments were, what the questions that were that came from Ginsburg and Kennedy and Alito and the others. A fascinating exchange this morning. In fact, Eric, by the way, it went 90 minutes. It went 30 minutes over, which is really unusual for a Supreme Court case. They were digging deep.
I was going to ask you, so you were there at outside the Supreme Court while these oral arguments were taking place, and it's Kristen Wagner, is that her name?
Yeah, Kristen Wagoner, who, by the way, has been a part of the Colson Center as one of our Colson Fellows, having studied with us for a year on Christian worldview.
She was the one, on behalf of Alliance Defending Freedom, making the oral argument for Jack Phillips and Masterpiece Cake Shop. So here's my question. Did you get to hear the arguments, or how do we get to hear? Were they broadcast someplace? I can't remember how they do it.
Yeah, no. The decision will come out on SCOTUS blog, but in this case, no. There's just been reports that have come out, and I talked to someone who walked right out of the courtroom, two attorneys, in fact.
Okay, so there's no recording of it. It's only people who were in the room to hear this stuff, and that they're not able to record it or anything, but people can interview them and say what happened.
Well, that's right. And the press was there. So Washington Post has already got articles up and in terms of what was said. So, yeah, no, the press was in there as well. And, of course, they both walked right out of the courtroom, both Jack Phillips and the plaintiffs. And they came out and gave their side of the story. And there was a large rally for both sides on the court, the steps of the courthouse there. And I got to tell you, I mean, this is one of those issues that divides America. But the deeper irony is that the whole case is about, we know that there are deep ideological divides in America. Are we going to allow opposing views to exist, or are we going to preemptively stamp them out? What I said in my speech at the rally, Eric, is that free speech and freedom of conscience is so important, because a government that compels speech and restricts how far you can take your privately held conviction to the public square is a government that essentially preempts the pursuit of truth. And that's what life is all about, to find out what's true. But if you cut off the argument up front, if you say you're not allowed in here, or you have to say what we want you to say, that actually cuts off the argument, the pursuit of truth. And America has been great because America has had this marketplace, this open marketplace, not only for commerce and business, but that's important too, but also in ideas, our deeply held convictions, that our deepest allegiances aren't to the state. Our deepest allegiances are fundamentally to God and to our conscience. And you preempt that sort of stuff in the public square, you have a poorer country in all kinds of ways.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Chuck Colson, I remember him saying that when you do this, let's say you're a gay activist, or let's say you're just somebody who doesn't share the Christian worldview, by cutting off religious freedom, you're sawing off the branch on which you are sitting. In other words, your right as a gay activist to say what you want was not crushed. People could not tell you to shut up. You had a right in America to to advocate. And as a result of those rights and a result of that kind of freedom, you were able to make the case. You were able to persuade American people that they should allow same-sex marriage, let's say, or they should have respect for people, even if they disagree with them. It's a foundational American value. All of our freedoms rest on these freedoms. And yet you have people who don't see that, or they say, well, we've got the power and we're going to try to crush dissent. That's fundamentally un-American, but it's worse than un-American. It's basically anti-freedom. It says we don't care about freedom. We don't care about truth. We got the power and we're going to force people to say what we want them to say, or we're going to force the government to force them to say what we want them to say. When you really understand this, even if you disagree with the Christian viewpoint, you still have to try and see that nobody wins. If you do this, you basically crush freedom itself. That's just a fact. It's not a Christian point of view. It's reality. We'll be right back talking to John Stone Street about the Supreme Court the Supreme Court case today. We'll be right back.
Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben? Come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown. Come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
Was a dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pig Pen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down. Cause we got a little
John Stone Street is my guest. John, I'm just cracking up thinking of you listening to this music. Thanks for being.
Hey, listen, I bet I'm the only guest that has a deep history in both rap and in old classic country. So I knew both of those songs.
Thank you. Thank you.
Too good to be
you
true.
Are hipper than anybody, I got to tell you right now. Okay, now you, sir, you're the head of the Colson Center. You do Breakpoint with me, and you today are in D.C. because the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this Jack Phillips case. So give us the breakdown. When do they make a decision, and why does it take them so long? How does this work?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is a long process. I mean, obviously thousands and thousands of pages of documentation were submitted that they have to go through. Today was the oral arguments. We won't see a decision probably till late June.
Late June,
yeah. And typically these cases have been almost among the last decisions they put out. And, you know, given a surprise, I don't think we're going to have a surprise based on what we saw. It's pretty much going to be 4-4, and the question is going to be where Kennedy goes.
I got to ask you, though, how could somebody like Sotomayor, Ginsburg, down the line, how could they possibly think it is okay to force somebody to do something like this? It's bizarre to me that these people could not get that. I don't get it.
No, well, it is. But, I mean, you can look at Sotomayor's Cal Berkeley speech from about 4 years before she was confirmed under the Supreme Court. And she actually says to judge is an exercise of power. I mean, she actually quotes, it's a very kind of postmodern Michel Foucault sort of view, to judge is an exercise
of power. Well, look, even if you agree it's an exercise of power, I don't have a problem with that. That's a perspective. The question
yeah, but that's
is
different than saying to judge is an exercise of interpretation. And what we're talking about here, Eric, is the rights of the First Amendment. That's guaranteed, that we have the right to think and to believe. If you think that judging really is to impose your view and to move society in a progressive direction.
But you think she believes
really
that?
A lot of these
I don't know that she believes. In other words, I would think that they would argue that they are trying to that they see things differently. This is not just that they disagree and they want to exert their power, or maybe, I guess.
It's a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, look, she has judged, and I'll be the first to say she has judged better than that philosophy. But that is the philosophy that she clearly articulated, and if you look at that speech, it's actually worse than that. I mean, she kind of sounds almost thoroughly top to bottom, like a postmodernist. But her rulings haven't been as bad as that philosophy. But I think you're right. I mean, I think what has happened is that the LGBT community has been equated with a persecuted group in the same sense as African Americans. The comparisons, I mean, today that I heard on the court steps from the other side about, you know, that this is like, you know, segregation and Jim Crow laws. And I mean, you know, that you don't get the cake you want. You can't force a baker to bake the cake you want. I mean, this couple could have walked down the street. I mean, literally.
Well, this is
if Jack Phillipson found another one.
We're going to have more. We're going to talk more with you on this. We're out of time right now, unfortunately. Sure. But John Stone Street, my friend, thank you so much. We look forward to talking with you more on this and other things.
Thanks, Eric.
Folks, go to MetaxasTalk.com. Tell your friends about this program. We appreciate it. Just go around.